Views and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and contributors, and not necessarily those of WFSU Public Media.
You tuned in to 411 Teen, a weekly program for teens, parents, families, educators, and other interested folks. 411 Teen provides a forum to examine and discuss various issues and events that confront, intersect, and sometimes interrupt our daily lives. I'm Dr. Liz Holyfield. We're diving into a serious and often misunderstood condition, obsessive-compulsive disorder. OCD is a debilitating mental health disorder that affects all ages. It involves obsessions, unwanted intrusive thoughts, and compulsion, behaviors people engage in to reduce the distress those thoughts cause. Meredith Hetler, National Director of OCD and Anxiety Program at Newport Healthcare, joins us. Newport Healthcare is a provider of evidence-based health treatment for youth, adults, and families. It is part of a full continuum of including psychiatric, inpatient services, residential services, partial hospitalization services, intensive outpatient, and virtual programs. Our program today, we hope to educate and demystify OCD. Meredith Hetler, National Director of OCD and Anxiety Program at Newport Healthcare, joins this edition of 411 Teen via the Zoom platform. Meredith, welcome to 411 Teen.
Thank you so much for having me.
Appreciate it. What is the clinical definition of OCD?
Sure. So the clinical definition of OCD is best identified as what I would call a two-part problem. And what I mean by that is part one of the two parts, and as you mentioned in your introduction, is obsessions. So obsessions are intrusive, unwanted thoughts, images, or perceived impulses that someone has. Mm-hmm. They tend to be scary. Again, they tend to be unwanted. They create distress. They create fear. They create anxiety. Now, the second part of that problem is compulsions. So compulsions can be something outward, like hand washing for someone who is experiencing contamination-based OCD, or it could also be internal. Now, the point of a compulsion or the purpose as it is within the context of OCD is to bring down the fear or to alleviate the fear or anxiety or distress that's caused by the obsession. So to put this in an example, as I mentioned just before about contamination-based OCD, what this would look like if an individual perhaps had a fear of touching maybe something in the bathroom, like their sink. Mm-hmm. That is the obsession. If I touch this part of my sink, I'm going to get sick. Or if I touch this part of my sink, there's germs on here that will make me dirty or will make me contaminated. So if that person accidentally touches that part of the sink, the compulsive behavior could be then to wash their hands. And when we look at the compulsion element of OCD, this isn't something that's happening quick. This isn't just, I wash my hands once. This is intensive. So people who are experiencing OCD, they're engaging in both the obsessive and compulsive elements for over an hour a day. Unfortunately, for individuals who are experiencing more severe or extreme OCD, this can be hours and hours in a day, up to 8, 10, 12 hours, unfortunately, for some people.
How does OCD differ from quirks or habits or even the need for perfection?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I'm glad you brought it up because I think that we often hear even the language in our workplace or in our life of I'm so OCD or I'm feeling like I'm being OCD right now. But there is a big difference. So, OCD, a good way to describe it is almost as if it's like a sticky thought in one's brain. every one person, any one of us might have a strange or bizarre or unwanted or intrusive thought. But with what happens with OCD is these thoughts get stuck. And they create, again, a lot of fear or distress for someone that then causes the compulsions to start. And a big difference between that idea of someone having maybe a quirky habit is, one, for someone who's experiencing OCD, it's not just a quick thing. This is something, again, that's happening over and over and can be going on for extended periods of time in a day. But the other thing to note as well is that OCD is what we would call ego dystonic. So what the person is experiencing, both in terms of the obsession and the compulsive behavior, there's nothing pleasurable or wanted about it. And it's also something that's, again, it creates a lot of fear for these individuals. So someone may have a quirky behavior, say, of wanting to, you know, organize their house very well or having their books on their bookshelf organized in a rainbow color. They may almost take some pleasure in that because it's neat and organized. Someone with OCD, they're not going to take any pleasure in that. It's a very unwanted and distressing cycle that they're experiencing.
So OCDs are, let's say, the compulsion component of an OCD can be just about anything from washing and cleaning to mental compulsions to even religious things.
Yes.
Anything. I mean, it's what you are have decided it's going to be, I should put. It's whatever you have. That individual has that high anxiety or stress, and that can be, that will be it. That's what it's going to be, right?
Yeah, essentially, yes. You know, there's, again, I think some preconceived notions about OCD. You know, we often recognize it as, you know, cleanliness or organization, but it can really take on a variety of different subtypes. So in along with contamination or organization, it could be aggressive type intrusive thoughts. It could be things that are, you know, of a sexual nature. It could be what we would call like existential OCD, or even something referred to as just right OCD, which essentially means that you are trying to do something a certain way until it feels just right. We'll also see it in subtypes that I think are a little bit harder for people to detect. That might be something like relationship OCD, where you have an excessive amount of doubt around the relationship you're in. And the doubt is a huge element, or probably the biggest element of OCD. I like to tell my clients a lot that OCD is kind of looking for 1,000% certainty around something, which obviously we can't have, but it's going to keep searching. It's all about, you know, what if I am this, or what if this does happen, or what if I do get sick? A lot of that idea of I don't have certainty around this and I'm going to keep searching for it.
You know, I've seen it in where the client may have a fear of, how should I say, catching the other person's personality.
Yes.
Okay.
Yep.
Yeah.
Okay. That's in the OCD treatment world, we call that essence contamination. Yep, that can be most definitely an example of OCD. And you had mentioned as well, scrupulosity or religious-based OCD. That's also very common. And it doesn't matter if you're religious or not, or you identify as spiritual or not, you know, really, again, whatever kind of the OCD wants to attach itself to, it can, and it will.
Exactly. Let's explore the contributing factors. I mean, is OCD hereditary? Is it environmental? Is it learned? Where does it fit?
Yeah, so at least as of now, the research is really indicating that it's more of a brain-based disorder. But most definitely, if you look at heredity or, you know, just family dynamics, if you're someone who's experiencing OCD, it's very likely that someone else in your family also has an OCD diagnosis, whether they realize it or not. There is talk as well, comes up a lot, especially in trainings that I do and when I'm working with newer therapists, talking about, you know, the relationship between trauma and OCD. Now, one thing to point out with that is someone can be predisposed to the potential to have OCD, and stress can kind of turn the dial up around that. So trauma doesn't necessarily lead to OCD, but stressful situations can exacerbate the potential for OCD to rear its ugly head at some point in someone's life.
Okay. And what do we know about, how shall I say, what do we know about OCD and the brain? I'm thinking about serotonin and brain circuitry. Do you know where does that stand?
Yeah. So, and I'll just say I am not a great brain scientist, but I'll give you my rudimentary explanation.
Yes, that's what we want.
Perfect. So, you know, if you were to look at studies of the brain, particularly like an fMRI study, you will definitely see differences in the brain of someone who has an OCD diagnosis versus someone who doesn't. Now, the question then is, you know, kind of what came first, the chicken or the egg? You know, is it that OCD caused these changes in the brain, or is it that the brain, you know, is functioning in a certain way, which therefore causes the OCD? So that's kind of why the jury's essentially still out. But to your point, if we look at, you know, the gold standard medications that we're using for OCD specifically, it is SSRIs, which obviously are serotonin reuptake inhibitors. And I guess the best way that I would describe kind of what's happening internally is that, like, the part of the brain that's really kind of letting you know whether or not there is or isn't something to be afraid of it's kind of hyperactive, essentially. So it's really kind of giving you messaging that things are really scary when they're not necessarily scary.
And you alluded to this a little bit when you were talking about triggers. And I wanted to ask, would you elaborate more on environmental triggers?
Yeah. So there's so much interesting research out there right now around this. So again, because the theory is that OCD is kind of a neuropsychiatric disorder, the thought is that the seed is already planted for OCD to potentially develop. Essentially, what can be a trigger is something that turns the dial up on already potentially pre-existing OCD, but you can see a direct connection. So a great example that I see often is maybe contamination-based OCD, where somebody experienced some type of trigger. So an example might be someone gets, say, a neurovirus and they get really, really sick. That might turn the dial up. And then they're thinking, oh my gosh, you know, I don't want to go through that again. So let me make sure I'm washing my hands, or let me not touch that thing, or let me not eat that thing because I might get sick again.
Hold your thoughts right there. That's perfect. Now we need to take a brief break, but we'll get right back at you. Just tuning in, the program is 411 Teen. I'm Dr. Liz Hollyfield, and Meredith Hetler with Newport Health Care joins us on the Zoom platform. Meredith, I had to interrupt you. We were talking about environmental triggers. I think you had mentioned infection. Somebody had something like COVID. Would you like to continue your thoughts?
Yeah, absolutely. So other places where you might see a potential trigger, I mean, you just mentioned COVID for sure. I think many people would say that going through the experience of being in a pandemic turned the dial up on their symptoms of OCD, or started it, essentially. Other places where you might see those environmental components, again, turning that dial up, could be maybe something, you mentioned perfectionism before, related to perfectionism. So if someone is really gung-ho on trying to get, you know, amazing grades at school, they might develop, say, magical thinking OCD, where they're taking something that was once, you know, kind of a fun superstition. I have to wear my purple shirt on test day so I get a good grade. And then all of a sudden it turns into, I cannot go to school without this purple shirt, because if I don't have it on, something bad's going to happen. So you can see, again, OCD, I like to describe it as having tentacles. It can start as one thing, but it can grow pretty quickly into something else.
How do certain life events And I'm thinking more now of psychological components trigger OCD.
So again, I think it's that similar idea of stress exacerbating something that was maybe already there. So if someone's going through stressful life events, you know, it makes them more vulnerable for the potential of that kind of OCD switch to turn itself on. And you may or may not see the OCD related to whatever that stressful life event was. Sometimes it's not related at all. Sometimes it is. And that's what I think really makes the disorder itself so complicated, because when someone is all of a sudden experiencing, or at least it feels like, all of a sudden or sudden onset experience of OCD, they're looking for answers. You know, why is this happening to me all of a sudden? And they're looking to connect the dots. But sometimes there are no dots to connect. It's just that the OCD was essentially there, and now it's rearing its ugly head. I will say, I do want to just make mention of PANS and PANDAS, which, for those who aren't familiar, is basically an infection. Well, part of an infection that can cause sudden onset OCD. It's typically related to something like strep, where strep can infect the brain and cause OCD. And then there are some theories that other infections like Lyme disease or Bartonella could also do something similar as well. So some people do experience very sudden onset symptoms of OCD as a result of these disorders or these diagnoses.
Well, I know it's often misdiagnosed with ADHD or anxiety. Share with us more subtle symptoms that may be manifested.
Yeah, I think that there's quite a few reasons why misdiagnosis happens, and especially if we're looking at maybe something like generalized anxiety versus OCD. To me, I think it comes down a lot to the subtype. So you could be working with someone who, again, maybe is experiencing that contamination-based OCD, which I think for most of us clinicians, we're able to see that as OCD because of the familiarity behind contamination and OCD. But something, as I was mentioning before, like relationship-based OCD, or for some individuals experiencing like sexual orientation OCD, the content might not be as noticeable to someone, therefore not realizing that this is actually something related to OCD. A good way for people to start to identify what they're looking at is that two-part problem versus a two-part solution, so which I can talk about later. But if we're looking at OCD, not only will we be seeing these obsessive thoughts, but we're also going to be seeing the compulsive behaviors. That's also a reason why I think it's sometimes hard for people to pick up on OCD, is because sometimes not only can the obsessive behaviors be subtle, but or the obsessive thoughts, but the compulsive behaviors could also be subtle. A good example of that might be reassurance seeking. You know, many people, I think off the bat, don't realize that reassurance seeking could be a compulsive behavior. And then as well, internal compulsions. Someone might be doing all of that compulsive behavior internally. And then finally, avoidance behaviors. Some people might say to me, well, I don't really engage in any compulsions. And that if we really peel back the curtain, it's because they're doing a lot of avoidance, so they don't have to experience whatever those triggers are.
Now, this may sound crazy to ask you this question, but how is it different from being obsessed? Because today we talk very just generally, oh, so-and-so is obsessed, or they're obsessing, they're being obsessed. Can you make a distinction?
No, I love that you asked that, because it actually comes up quite a bit.
Okay.
Especially for our younger population. You know, a way that I describe it is that you can be obsessed by way of the Webster's Dictionary. So that might be, like, gosh, when I was a teenager, I'm obsessed with NSYNC. I love them. Yeah. I think about them all the time. I've got all the posters up on my wall. But if we think about obsessions by way of the DSM, the big difference here is that, you know, when the DSM defines obsessions, it's intrusive, it's unwanted. Uh-huh. whereas someone could be obsessed, but there's a positive connotation to it. The other thing to think about is I'll have individuals who maybe are obsessed with, say, gambling. Now, they know that gambling's not good for them, nor is it helpful, and it's probably causing a lot of issues. And they're thinking about it all the time. But the difference between something like that and OCD is that gambling, in a way, is egosyntonic. You know, they're still gaining something that's, while maladaptive, has an element of positivity to it. Whereas, again, with OCD, it's nothing about it is something that the person wants to be partaking in any way. So those are, I think, two ways to think about it as well. But obsessions, when it comes to OCD, are intrusive, unwanted, create fear, they create distress. And then that second part, people are trying to get rid of them, essentially, through the compulsive acts that they're engaging in.
Let's take some time, if you will, to look at OCD and how it presents across the lifespan. What do we see in childhood or early onset? You know, I'm talking about the elementary school age child.
Yeah, so
that's, often it's misdiagnosed or overlooked at this time, but there are behaviors there.
Absolutely. The behaviors that someone might exhibit, of course, depend on the person and the type of OCD they're experiencing. But you will absolutely see those classic symptoms. You know, it could be, especially for little ones, like that reassurance seeking. Maybe you're seeing, it could be, you know, excessive touching of something or ordering and arranging things over and over, but to the point that it's causing distress. It's not something that's pleasurable. Avoidance behaviors, you know, it could be, like, hey, mom, I'm not going to Johnny's house anymore. Johnny's house is really dirty. Well, what does that really mean? You know, is it that Johnny's house is dirty or is there something else happening? Or maybe you're finding kids who are all of a sudden really worried about, you know, whether or not the house is going to set on fire, and they're checking and checking and checking the fire alarms to make sure everything's okay. So you could see things like that. And then, you know, as someone moves throughout their lifespan or if this is, you know, onset later on in life, more of the complexities may or may not show up. So certainly I have teens and young adults that I've worked with who experience more of that homicidal-based OCD, suicidal-based OCD, sexually aggressive-based OCD. Not that there's necessarily an age range where you'll see differences, but I think certainly older people are probably more able to communicate that versus someone younger.
What about making the distinction? I would think this would be extremely, maybe not that difficult, making the distinction for someone who is on the autism spectrum disorder, because a lot of the things, a lot of the subtle symptoms go along with being on that spectrum.
Yeah,
and they may not be, you know, they may not be OCD exactly, you know. So if you would talk about that.
Yeah, so a few things to look at. So for an individual who's on the autism spectrum, you could imagine that you would see a similarity in their behaviors throughout a lifespan, where someone with OCD might be functioning a certain type of way, and then once OCD shows up, you see a difference in their outward behavior. But a big piece to think about, and I know I just used the example of ordering and arranging things. Right. I think that really exemplifies how you can decipher the difference or differentiate between the two. So a behavior like ordering and arranging items, someone who is on the autism spectrum might take some type of pleasure or relief or enjoyment in that activity. You know, maybe it serves as a stimulatory behavior. Maybe it's enjoyable to them because it relates to, you know, something they're very much interested in. Whereas someone with OCD, again, it's that ego dystonic nature. They don't want to be doing that. They're saying, I hate that I'm organizing these things. I hate that I can't just leave my house without doing this. I don't want to be doing this. So that would be two ways or a way of kind of deciphering between the two. I'm trying to think if there's something else I want to mention with that. And yeah, I think with autism as well, certainly there's an element of rigidity that may or may not be part of someone's symptomology in terms of being on the autism spectrum. But again, you would likely see that behavior, you know, early on in their development mm-hmm. versus, again, someone with OCD who's maybe functioning, you know, without that rigidity. And then all of a sudden there's, you see a change and mm-hmm. that change maybe develops or becomes more severe over time.
Now, you did kind of allude to this, but how does OCD change or does it change as someone ages?
It can ebb and flow. Mm-hmm. The subtype can change, you know, the way the OCD presents, it can change over time. It can change in the course of, you know, someone's treatment process. So I think that a good way to sort of exemplify what happens is that OCD, again, is that sticky brain. Mm-hmm. So maybe at one point in someone's life, it relates to contamination. And then maybe years later, something kind of triggers or turns that dial up again on OCD. And then it relates to suicidality. So there's not really like a pattern that you might see it follow, but certainly it can morph in a variety of different ways throughout a lifespan.
Let's move to adolescence. What do we see during the adolescent period with OCD?
Yep. I mean, so again, similarly to how it might present for an adult experiencing mm-hmm. it for the first time, it can just, for lack of a better way to describe it, it could just kind of start and it can take on any of the subtypes that, you know, are common in the presentation of OCD. One piece though, that's very important for all family members, but especially for parents of kids and or adolescents, is that the family component, what we call mm-hmm. as family accommodation behavior, is really essential to understand. So what that means is that when a child or a teen is going through the experience of OCD, naturally family members start to lean in or accommodate that OCD. So that could be like, you know, hey, mom, I really need the soap that gets extra sudsy because that's the only thing that's going to make me feel better. And if I don't have that soap, mm-hmm. I won't go to school. Any parent, and I very much understand how this happens, any parent is going to say, well, gosh, I've got to get my kid to school. And they're really distressed if they don't have this soap. I'm just going to get them the soap. Mm-hmm. Or if you have a teen or a child who's, you know, just so distressed and they're saying, mom, please tell me that I'm not going to get, you know, cancer or whatever the disease might be that they're worried about. Again, any parent's going to see that distress and they're going to say, oh my gosh, no, you're not going to get that. You're okay. So now that cycle starts. So it's extraordinarily important for parents, you know, as their child is going through OCD treatment, to be doing work alongside them to bring down their own reinforcement of the compulsive behaviors.
You know, I often would say that in adolescence, and I want you to correct me if I'm wrong, with OCD, sometimes you can see a heightened self-awareness. I have seen that they are aware about a particular aspect of their style, their physical ability or whatever. But have you seen that? Do you see that? Does that exist during adolescence?
Yeah, I mean, I guess I would say I see, and because I think you'll probably similarly feel this way as well, that adolescence in and of itself is such a time where you have this sort of like that center stage feeling mm-hmm. of everybody's looking at me. I would say, I mean, certainly I've worked with kids who, and this isn't OCD, but it is kind of under the umbrella, but have, you know, experiences with body dysmorphic disorder, or you start to see like that perfectionism budding. I've had a lot of kids say things to me like, gosh, my perfectionism used to really help me, but now mm-hmm. it hinders me.
Yes. Yeah.
You know, so I've seen that quite mm-hmm. a bit, or maybe just even like social anxiety or social phobia sort of weaved within the context of OCD as well.
What about co-occurring conditions? And now I'm thinking about substance abuse and depression. Do you see that?
Yes. Probably, I mean, a bit anecdotal. I don't know what the stats are.
Yeah, I don't either.
Substance use, probably not as much, but certainly depression. You know, these individuals, especially people who are really like going through kind of severe or extreme OCD, you know, oftentimes they're you know, not able to live life nearly to the fullest that they deserve to be living it. Mm-hmm. You know, they're often stuck in these rituals for hours in a day and starting to feel essentially hopeless, which of course can lead to feelings of depression. Let's see. I mean, obviously, we certainly see people with anxiety and OCD. At Newport, we treat individuals with co-occurring trauma and mm-hmm. OCD, and then often neurodivergence, so autism and OCD, ADHD and OCD. We'll certainly see that as well.
What signs for parents who are listening? What signs should I know we've given them a lot, you know, to try to digest, but what signs should parents be aware of?
Yes, I love that you're asking that, because again, there's so many subtleties to OCD mm-hmm. that it is easy to miss some of the behaviors. So if you're seeing anything that seems maybe excessive, so okay. not anything, but it, you know, excessive behaviors in and of itself could be something completely different. Yeah. But if all of a sudden, you know, your child who used to love playing outside is no longer playing outside, and all of a sudden maybe they're washing their hands a lot, or they're mm-hmm. wearing gloves, or wait a second, they used to really love to eat, you know, X, Y, and Z food, and now they're refusing it, saying it's, you know, it's gross or it's dirty or it's contaminated, or all of a sudden you're seeing avoidance behaviors, you know, mom, I can't go to my friend's house, dad, I'm not going to school. And then you're seeing that part too as well. So, you know, avoidance or trying to reduce anxiety or fear. If you're seeing, you know, excessive organizing, I would question that. I'm thinking,
let me ask you to hold your thoughts and we'll get right back at you. You're tuned in to 411 Teen. We are talking about OCD. We're going to take a break, but we'll return shortly.
Views and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and contributors, and not necessarily those of WFSU Public Media.
Just tuning in, the program is 411 Teen. We have Meredith Hettler. She is the National Director of OCD and Anxiety at the Newport Healthcare. Meredith, I had to interrupt you. Did you want to continue anything that you were talking about as far as signs for parents to be aware of?
Yeah, I think the last thing I'll say as well is just if you're noticing fear, anxiety, or distress, or if kids just, and teens, if they're not doing the things that they were once doing. And, you know, unfortunately, though, there are times, of course, where the OCD symptoms are so overt that it's pretty quick for parents to notice. Mm-hmm. But I would say if you're not sure, and or if all of a sudden things seem to be rapidly, you know, increasing in intensity, go right into getting a therapist to support you and trying to understand what you're looking at and how to move forward.
Okay. And that leads right into my next question, which I think you've answered, which is just at what point should parents seek professional help? And in the selection of a therapist, what should they look for? Because everybody, you know, it's hard to find someone whose specialty is OCD and anxiety, particularly with kids and adolescents.
Yes. So I would say in terms of at what point, mm-hmm. the earlier the better, because OCD, it negatively reinforces itself through the act of obsessions and compulsions. So it can become much more severe quickly. So mm-hmm. we want to make sure that we're able to kind of tackle it and give kids and teens the skills that they need to handle the OCD, you know, symptoms, hopefully independently. And then in terms of therapy, so if someone is seeking OCD treatment, they need to be looking for a therapist who's trained in exposure and response prevention therapy, or ERP. Okay. So ERP is essentially the gold standard treatment model for obsessive compulsive disorder. So that's essential for anyone looking for OCD treatment, to make sure that they have a therapist who does ERP therapy.
Okay. Let's talk about diagnosis. What should the parents be looking for? What does a complete and thorough diagnosis include?
Yep. So parents should be looking for someone who is addressing those two parts of the two-part problem, so both the obsessions and the compulsions, as it would be outlined in the DSM. And in conjunction with that, most therapists are going to be doing or completing what we would call a CYBOX or a Y-box. So a CYBOX is called the Children's Yale-Brown Obsessive Compulsive Scale. YBOX is the adult version, and this is basically the gold standard assessment tool to measure the severity of OCD, and then it's also utilized throughout treatment to make sure that we're going through, that our clients have treatment efficacy. The assessment itself is broken into two parts. The first part is a symptom checklist, so it will bring the client through really probably almost every symptom that you could almost think of in terms of OCD. There's about 58 questions on the symptom checklist. And then the final 10 questions are around the severity. So the severity rating is based out of 40. So it, really anyone who's kind of scoring in the high 20s or above is experiencing pretty severe to extreme OCD. But we want to make sure that the clinicians that are treating our kids and young adults with OCD are engaging with that assessment.
Well, as we talk about kids and adolescents, we have to include the schools. And what role do the schools play, and what role can they play? I mean, I know that their roles are difficult, to say the least, because they're in school and teachers aren't trained. And I'm getting into a lot of the answers, but I know teachers just aren't trained to identify that. So where do the schools sit with all of this?
Yeah, I find, at least in my experience, that the schools that I've worked with have been just so receptive to learning about OCD. Mm-hmm. And so while they, of course, aren't necessarily going to be providing any type of direct therapy.
Oh, no.
Their awareness of, you know, what to do and what to not do in terms of OCD is extremely helpful. So a great example I've mentioned before about reassurance seeking. So if I have a client who I'm treating for OCD whose compulsion is reassurance seeking, and I know not to give reassurance because that reinforces the OCD, mom and dad now know, don't give reassurance. But we've got to make sure that the other adults in this person's life also understand. So that would be a great opportunity for myself as a therapist to work with the school and say, hey, you know, when little Johnny comes in and he asks you if his desk is dirty, here's what we want you to say. Mm-hmm. Because we don't want them inadvertently reinforcing OCD. So I think that psychoeducation that a therapist can provide the school system is really essential to just the overall treatment success of a client.
Okay. And I know this exists. There is still a stigma associated with mental health issues. Mm-hmm. Do you have any suggestions to the client or the parents as to what they can do to help smooth, I guess, this stigma, to help them cope with the stigma? You know, hey, why does Johnny do that? He's weird. Why, you know, that kind of thing.
Yes. So a few things about that. I think one, fortunately, there's been a few celebrities who have actually come out recently talking about their own experiences with OCD. I really just appreciate that that's happening now, because I think, you know, with these big names being able to speak openly, it starts to open the door for everybody else to feel okay about it. But the other thing that I recommend to especially our families at Newport, and then families that I and clients that I see outside of Newport, They need to get involved in communities. So unfortunately, at Newport, we kind of wrap ourselves around the parents and the kids who are with us. So they really start to, as I always say, especially to the parents, you know, you're not on a lonely island anymore. Mm-hmm. You have other people who are in your corner. So there, you know, we get our families hooked up with parent support groups and our alumni app and all of these resources to help connect them with others so they can have that experience of not being alone and realizing that, you know, it's not just their child who's struggling, that everybody of all walks of life have their own experiences. Right. And then outside of that, you know, for individuals who aren't in our care and in particular related to OCD, I recommend that anyone who's experiencing symptoms of OCD check out the International OCD website. So it's the International OCD Foundation. They're wonderful. I, you know, can't say enough about this organization. They do such an amazing job connecting people. It could be kids, families, teens, young adults to one another, really to help dispel that stigma, to, you know, give them that sense of connection and normalcy and just peer support. They do nationally a lot of really wonderful, you know, local events, community groups. They have the IOCDF walks at a variety of different places all over the country. And the International OCD convention that happens every year is wonderful because it's certainly not just a place for clinicians or practitioners. There's quite a few, you know, individuals with OCD and their families that join as well. So I think my advice to anyone would be just to get yourself out there into, you know, support groups and communities to really help you just lift yourself up during these difficult times when you're experiencing a mental health crisis.
May I ask you to repeat the apps, because you have anticipated what I was going to say, which was, are there any hotlines or apps that you would recommend for parents or teens to be utilized? And you said did, but I just wanted you to repeat them, just that, you know, the apps are the website, so that those folks who are listening can get it down and maybe refer to them.
Sure. So I would recommend for anybody listening to go to the IOCDF website.
Okay.
So that's the International OCD Foundation. There's tons of resources and info there.
Okay.
And then, you know, of course, you know, Newport, where I work, we provide quite a bit on our website as well, of resources and information to really geared towards anyone. You know, I write a lot of articles for the website about family needs related to OCD, different subtypes, you know, where to go and look for X, Y, and Z information. So that's always something as well. And then, of course, you know, for anyone in need, I would definitely recommend that they utilize the crisis lines like 988. I mean, that's an essential hotline for kids and teens alike if they need something more in an emergent, you know, for emergent reasons.
Okay. What about the parents who become burnt out?
Yeah.
You have any tips on managing just, you know, being burnt out?
Yeah. I think when it comes to OCD, a few things. One, remembering that this is, their child is not OCD. You know, there's a, like, really separating out the two. You know, I think it's easy for parents to get into that habit of saying, you know, why can't you just stop?
When it's so much exactly. That.
So, like, really educating themselves on what OCD is, why their child is engaging with these behaviors, what the struggles are, and really just kind of depersonalizing OCD or externalizing it from their child. I think that can really help parents have a bit more bandwidth in dealing with, you know, the difficulties that come with parenting someone who's experiencing OCD. And then again, I think that I would also recognize or recommend that parents are seeking their own therapy when their child is struggling, because, you know, it's already tough to be a parent, but then when you have a child struggling, you know, it's going to trigger a lot for somebody. It brings up everything from the surface that maybe you didn't even know you had in there. So you want to make sure that you're doing your own work as a parent to just ease as much of the burden as possible. And then those resources that I mentioned before, you know, getting involved with a community of people, seeking out help, you know, finding other people who can be it a therapist, you know, psychiatrist, maybe someone in your religious community, but people who can be a part of your tribe who are helping you during this difficult time.
Okay. And I know we've already mentioned this about the GOLD treatment, but in ERP, is medication an option? How effective?
Yeah, yes. Medication? So medication most definitely is an option. If we look at really what the gold standard treatments are for OCD,
okay.
Most definitely ERP, as I mentioned, mm-hmm. and then SSRI medication tends to be like the frontline treatment for clients who are either interested in or it's recommended that they also utilize medication to support their reduction of OCD symptoms.
What about that individual who treatment doesn't seem to work? And I'm saying this and I'm thinking about new emerging kind of treatments, you know, deep brain stimulation, TMS, ketamine. Mm-hmm. What are your thoughts on what options they may pursue?
Yeah, so I think I would first, especially when it comes to OCD treatment, I would first look at the level of care before anything else. And I say that because OCD and ERP treatment is what we would consider like a dose model. So essentially, the more severe the OCD is, the more ERP we want someone doing.
Mm-hmm.
And it, oftentimes where people are struggling with their treatment is if they're not really able to do the exposure work outside of their, you know, say their outpatient therapy sessions. They need to be doing it a lot. So if someone's in, for example, in an outpatient setting and they're maybe seeing a therapist one time a week and they're saying, gosh, I am not getting better. My OCD is getting worse. That would be the first thing that I would look at of is it enough treatment? And then clinically, I might recommend, you know, perhaps this person looks at a higher level of care, be it, you know, what we would call like a PHP, which is like a day program or something residentially. If none of that is working, if they've tried all the meds, I guess what I would say is I would go back to the data and the research. You know, there's definitely some research out there that TMS might have some benefit. But I would really rely for any individual to, you know, consult with whoever their psychiatrist was or their, you know, medication providers on whether or not that they were recommending something like that would be helpful.
Can people recover from OCD?
Oh, yeah, for sure. Okay. That's the one of the beautiful things about exposure and response prevention therapy. It works. I always tell my clients that the goal I have for them is to be their own best therapist. You know, if they really learn to live and breathe that therapy model, and essentially what the model is asking people to do is to face their fears and then not engage in compulsions. I know that sounds very much easier said than done.
That's exactly what I was going to say. That's easier said than done.
100%. We do it in a very graduated way. You know, obviously there's a therapist guiding them through how to do this, how to reduce the compulsions. So it certainly takes the support of a therapist to be able to really attune yourself to this model. But most definitely, I have seen clients really internalize these skills that they're learning through ERP and be able to just take it out into the world and know exactly how to handle OCD should it arise. I'll give a great example. I had a person years ago that had told me they had lots of contamination-based fears and were able to go to places that, you know, would have triggered the OCD just proactively. You know, even though they were feeling fine, they were saying, I should probably go to this thing because, you know, years ago this bothered me, but I want to make sure I'm facing it all the time. Or, you know, hey, I'm really afraid of, again, maybe we'll use vomit as an example again. I had a past fear of vomit and contamination OCD. So now I know this kid in my class has a stomach virus. I'm going to make sure I sat in his seat. You know, so we want them to really be able to like fully immerse themselves in what this model looks like. And be able to just live it and breathe it every day. And even if they're not sure if it's OCD or they think maybe it's not, but they're still going to act as if it is, mm-hmm. that really helps kind of keep the symptoms from ever coming back and being too intense.
Okay. We're at the last 2 minutes, so what would you offer as the final takeaway you want for the listening audience? 30 seconds, I guess.
Yeah. I would say that I just want people to know that there is most definitely hope when mm-hmm. it comes to OCD. Mm-hmm. People do, and they can get better. And even when OCD is telling you that you can't do it, you can. And just to trust yourself that that you've got the strength and resilience to move forward.
Well, thank you. What didn't I cover?
I think you covered most of it. I guess I would just tell people if they're not sure where to look for treatment, again, the IOCDF website. And also they can always reach out to Newport Healthcare. Okay. We have a really wonderful team at Newport who can point you in all sorts of the right directions. Okay. So I would recommend those two things.
Well, it's time out for this edition of 411 Teen. Many thanks to Meredith Hettler, offering a wealth of information on OCD. Much appreciation to my listening audience for the privilege of your time and ear. I'm Dr. Liz Holyfield, inviting you to tune in next week, same time, same place, to get the 411 on 411 Teen. 411 Teen was produced by Dr. Liz Holyfield. Technical assistance was provided by Evan Rossi. If you would like to participate in the 411 Teen or have suggestions for discussion topics, call 850-645-7200. You can listen to previous episodes of 411 Teen at wfsu.org.